This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Hey, what's up, everybody? It's Dirt. I want to thank you for taking some time out to listen to the podcast of our show, brought to you by Les Schwab Tires, doing the right thing since 1952.
From Ric Flair right to talking to an economics professor at Yale.
Boy, this guy's too smart for this show, but I'm glad he's agreed to come on, as we're joined now by Yale finance professor Toby Moskowitz, and he joins us now. First of all, Toby, thanks so much for hopping on with us. Could you explain to our listeners, because I don't want to ruin the intro here, exactly what your specific study is in economics, finance, and what you do?
Oh, yeah. No, first of all, thanks for having me, guys. So I'm a professor of finance, study finance and economics, but also dabble in sports and sports analytics. In fact, I teach a sports analytics course at Yale. And you might think, what does that have to do with economics? But that's what tenure buys you. You get to study whatever you want.
There we go.
And wrote a book many years back called Scorecasting with my good buddy John Wertheim at Sports Illustrated, where we talk a bit about these issues.
All right, great. All right, I'm just going to get out here. I'm an idiot, Toby, so bear with me here. I try to read as much as I can and being informed as much as I can. And we're to a point, I think, economically as a country, we're really torn and everybody's arguing about this or that. I'll just put it in layman's terms. Are we effed? Where are we at right now as an economy?
I mean, it's pretty bleak at the moment, but there's not a lot I think we can do about it. This is a major crisis with the virus, and probably the best way, if people are trying to figure out what the best way is to get out of it. But I think there's only one way out of it, which is to get this thing under control. So it's not going to be easy, right? I'm at home now. So by the way, if you hear my kids screaming in the background, apologies to listeners. We're all working remotely. But I think the best course of action is to try to get through this as quickly as we can. It's tough, right? Everything's shut down.
Yeah.
Well, and you know, nobody knows how this is going to go, just from a virus standpoint, and how, you know, when's it going to take to kind of peak and go down, and how long is this going to be a new normal for us? But have you played out kind of in your mind a best case, worst case scenario for the economy of how long it would take to reach either point?
Yeah, I mean, it's always hard. You know, some of my colleagues at Yale who work with the medical school have run scenarios and models. My wife is a physician. She's on top of all the medical aspects of this. I mean, I think the thing that people have to remember, which is something that as an economist I hadn't realized until, you know, it's mentioned and it's sort of obvious, which is, even if we sort of peak, let's say we shut down for the next couple of weeks, and then, you know, we get past the peak and things start to diminish, what we've seen in other countries like South Korea and China is when we lift those restrictions, the virus comes back too, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, what this is really trying to do is buy us time. And to be honest, you know, I don't think we can shut, you know, if you said we have to shut down for a year, I don't think that's going to be possible. And I don't think people would put up with it.
Right.
But, you know, the numbers that I'm seeing from, you know, some sources, credible sources, is that, look, if we're able to hold on and shut down for, let's say it's a couple of months, and the schools have already done this, we might actually get ahead of this thing, get on top of it, and that might be all it takes. Mm. It's not going to be completely eradicated, but we'd be on top of it. And I think people don't understand the disruption you would get from just the overrunning of hospitals. And let's be honest, people will be sick too. Right. When you're sick, you're not working either. And this thing, at least for a reasonable percentage of people, takes its toll.
Yeah, Toby Moskowitz is our guest here, finance professor at Yale University. You talk about playing out both models And, you know, I think a lot of people, they don't want to do the doom and gloom. Best case scenario, if it goes 2 months, like how quickly, I don't even know how to grasp some of this stuff because, again, I'm an idiot. If it goes like 2 months, let's say, how quickly could something like recovering an economy go?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, I think the best response, the stuff that I'm hearing from both economists and scientists and medical experts is, it's a combination of shutting down for 2 months and using targeted economic remedies and targeted sectors going back to work. So, for instance, if we knew where the virus was, if we did a lot more testing, and we knew, like, let's say, you know, hey, look, it's really concentrated in right now in New York, in Connecticut, where I am. It's not so bad in the Midwest, right? So there's no reason we have to shut down everywhere all the same time. If you know there are places where, you know, things aren't that bad and there's not a lot of contagion, you can probably loosen the restrictions. In other places, you can clamp down. But if you do it more targeted, the economy is not going to suffer as much. And we get a hold of this thing. We know where to, you know, to send the resources. But, you know, best case scenario, I think if we did, you know, I think that the most optimistic picture would be if we did, you know, millions and millions of tests, and we're nowhere even close to that. We're doing, you know, on the orders of thousands. We need to be doing a lot more than that. Mm-hmm. Understanding where the virus is and in targeted areas, shutting down and possibly even quarantining certain areas for weeks at a time, I think we get ahead of this thing within a few months. And, you know, you would hope that by mid to end of the summer, we're doing okay, and we're not that far off, let's say, from treatments or vaccines that will get rid of this thing. Mm. But I think, you know, people are sort of hoping, oh, well, once the summer comes, it'll disappear like the flu. There's no evidence that that's the case. Right. We just don't know.
Right, right. Well, we've all been waiting kind of to see what the relief package was going to look like, and I haven't seen today. I don't know if it's passed yet, but they apparently reached an agreement last night. So I don't know how closely you've looked into it, but I'm just curious, what should the tenets of a relief package look like? You know, maybe $1,200, it sounds like, per person, and is that enough of a Band-Aid in the short term?
So that's a great question. I mean, I you know, talking to most, well, I'll tell you my opinion, and I think a number of economists sort of agree with this. You know, just handing people a check and thinking that that's going to stimulate the economy, I just don't see that that's going to do much. And in fact, markets have responded in a pretty meager way, mm-hmm. suggesting that they don't think it's going to do that much. And the reason why is, suppose I hand you, you know, say it's a $2,000 check, right? Are you going to go out and start going to restaurants? And first of all, there are no sporting events to spend the money on, or other things. No, you're going to sit on it. You're going to wait until things recover. It's not going to stimulate the economy. I think, you know, some interesting things that other, and we can learn from some other governments that are trying some neat experiments. One of which is in Denmark, where what they're doing is they've told companies that if they don't lay off their employees during this period, the government will pay 75% of the payroll. Now, what's nice about that is it's interesting about it, is it injects money into the economy, but it also keeps people at work. And let's face it, people want to be busy. You're stuck at home. I think the real scare for the economy is this massive unemployment rate we already saw last week. That's going to get worse. So if we could sort of stem that, it would possibly stimulate the economy, or at least in the meantime, keep people working and keep the companies afloat so that when we bounce back, things will bounce back quickly. And one other point on that, which is the businesses I worry about the most are the small businesses, the restaurants, the gymnasiums, the yoga studios, all these kinds of things. They barely survive as it is. They can't shut down for even a month or two and survive. And it's very hard to get them back up started. So if we subsidize those places, it kept them afloat for a few months, while we got ahead of this thing, I think the economy, my opinion is, it would bounce back much faster.
Yeah, you know, Toby, I saw an article that a lot of restaurants and bars in downtown Portland are worried that like half of them won't even be able to reopen once everything kind of gets back into flow. And, you know, you got other people's opinions out there on this kind of stuff. What I'm kind of curious of is when you talk about a relief bill and you talk about spending money, because you're right. Like, if I get a check from the government, I'm going to try to support some local here and there. But for the most part, I'm just going to stack my money because I don't know what the future of this situation is.
That's right. Yeah. So why not give it to these local restaurants to keep them afloat for 2 months so that when things come back, your favorite restaurant's still there. Because I think that's the bigger danger here.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, everybody's kind of keeping an eye on the stock market and wondering what the best way to approach it is. And it has been quite the roller coaster, mostly a downturn here the last couple of weeks. Do you have any advice for how to handle the stock market right now?
Yeah, don't look. I mean, that's my best advice. You know, it's if you're a long-term investor, like we should all be, it's best not to look. I said the same thing back in 2008 when I was teaching this at the University of Chicago. And, you know, years later, it all bounced back and looked fine. I think it's very difficult to time the markets. And I think with so much volatility and uncertainty right now, if you try to do too much, you're more likely to do more harm than you are good. You know, having said that, I think, you know, it's probably not a bad idea to have, and hopefully people had this before this, have some cash on the side in case you need it. You need something liquid that you can use just in case you need to dip into that sort of rainy day fund. This is pretty rainy these days. But I think it's awfully tough to try to do anything strategic really anytime, but especially in a market like this.
Yeah. This is Toby Moskowitz, finance professor at Yale University. As he mentioned, he also dives into sports analytics, and we'll get into some sports stuff with you, Toby. But we wanted to kind of help inform our listeners on some of this stuff because it can be confusing to navigate through a lot of different stories. You know, you mentioned Denmark, and I had seen that as well, that they were covering wages up to 75%. I love that. I really love it because I think what you're talking about in supporting the local businesses is really the most important part. But what people, critics against that would say is it's not realistic because of the size of our country. Is that feasible to do something of that nature here in America?
Well, it's interesting. Is it feasible, you know, financially? I think yes. Is it feasible politically? Probably not. I think, you know, if we wanted to do that as a society, we absolutely could do it. You know, Denmark is spending, I think they're spending about the same amount we are, but it's a much smaller country. So it's pretty impressive. I'm not saying that I don't think we could support every business in the U.S. No, that's probably not feasible. But if we could support targeted, you know, take something like the airlines, right? I mean, there's rumors that Delta may go under, that other major airlines. That's a huge disruption to the economy that doesn't get fixed very quickly, right? So to me, and I think the bill that was approved is directed at, you know, say the airlines, but not so much small businesses. I haven't seen the bill yet. But to me, that's where we should be focusing our efforts. No, we can't bail out everybody. We can't keep everybody afloat. That's just the nature of these things. But the more we can do to stave off a depression, which is what you're really worried about, that's what I think we should do. And, you know, one of the key things that labor economists have found is that job search is very, very costly, right? So it's much harder when you lose a job to find a new one. And anybody who's listening knows this, anyone who's gone through this, than it is to, you know, if you keep your job and you're just kept afloat a little bit longer, it's much easier to ramp back up and go straight back to that work. I mean, if we have everybody having to restart and do a new job search in a couple of months because these small businesses are no longer there, that's a huge disruption to the economy. It's going to delay things, you know, maybe another 6 months to a year.
Yeah. You know, one kind of random thing out of this that I'm wondering how it all plays out. We have long advocated on this show, mainly out of laziness, that we prefer a 4-day work week and a 3-day weekend. But now we have like a huge chunk of the workforce that hasn't been laid off yet. The vast majority of them are working from home in kind of this new hybrid, some in office, some at home. What kind of an impact do you think that has long term? I feel like it's a case for kind of a case study just of how this might work in a new economy after all of this is settled.
Well, I think that's a good way to look at the positive aspects of something like this, which is, I mean, okay, we'd all love the pandemic to go away, but you can learn something from events like this. And I actually think you learn the most from crises because it puts us in a position that we wouldn't otherwise have put ourselves. One thing is, I think we're learning a lot about remote working, and I agree with you completely. I think you're going to see more efficiency. I've seen this with, you know, I work at Yale, but I also work with an investment management firm, AQR Capital. And while I'm working remotely from both jobs, nobody's traveling, and yet we're still getting a ton of stuff done. And I think we're going to realize that there's a lot of things that we could do a lot more efficiently, at less cost, less disruption to our personal lives. I think you're going to see people being able to do 3- and 4-day work weeks, not having to commute every day, which is a huge waste of time. you know, especially I work out here in the you know, New York, New Jersey, Connecticut area, people are commuting easily an hour a day each way, so 2 hours a day. If you could cut that out even by one day a week, that would be a huge gain in productivity. And the thought was always that you needed to be there in person. I think we're learning that actually you don't really need to be. We're teaching online right now. It's going fine so far. Yeah. It's not ideal, but it's not bad.
Yeah. Yeah. One-on-one meetings could be even more, you know, more productive if you're just in and out because nobody wants to hang out on FaceTime all day. This is Toby Moskowitz, Yale finance professor, joining us here to just kind of break everything down economically because we're too stupid to do it. And Toby is much more gifted at this than we are. You know, I was listening to a podcast on Hidden Brain and they talked about the Spanish flu pandemic in 1918. And you know, I drew was kind of like how scary it is to being similar to what we're experiencing now. And it's almost like we didn't learn from that 100 years ago and we're relearning it now. Do you think based on what you've heard, what you've read, I know you said you haven't seen the relief bill yet, but based on what you have read and people you've talked to, do you feel like we really learned from the 08 crash and maybe even going way back the Great Depression?
Well, I think we did. Did we learn enough? I'm not sure. And it's always a different event. But one thing we did learn in the 08 crash is a lot of quantitative easing and other policies that the Fed used at that time, those have become very, very helpful right now. So as one example, and I work with a former Fed governor who's now teaching at Yale with me. And one of the things he said was, you know, the nice thing about having the 08 experience is we had all this stuff already prepared, already ready off the shelf. And it was just, you could snap your fingers and implement it, right? I mean, you didn't have to go through what was this going to do. We already had experience doing this. So some of the Fed methods that were deployed over the last couple of weeks were from the 2008 crisis, and they knew what the effect would be and how it would help. Now, they're trying lots of other stuff as well. This is a very different kind of crisis. But that, I think, has been very helpful. And it's helpful in other ways, too. I mean, I know some of my colleagues are advising, you know, developing governments who never tried this and are going to have to deal with it themselves, and they have no idea how to implement some of these measures for their central banks, and they can learn from some of the U.S. and European experiences in the 2008 crisis.
Yeah.
Now, going back to the pandemic in the Spanish flu in 1918, you know, there's been a lot of work documenting what happened there. Obviously, very different sort of time, and I think, you know, there's definitely a lot of academic work on how the disease tracked, what the impact was. This is how we learned, for instance, about flattening the curve. You saw big differences in, say, Philadelphia that decided not to do it versus St. Louis that did. Huge differences. We've learned from that. But yes, yeah, I think we can learn a lot, and we can learn a lot from, you know, experiments other countries are doing.
Yeah. Toby, I'm going to ask you a favor kind of on the fly, and I'm crossing my fingers here. Our commercial breaks are super short right now. They're like a minute and a half. Would you be willing to hang on for about a minute and a half and come back? Because we have more questions on this, and then I want to get into some sports stuff with you, too.
Sure, no problem.
All right, thank you so much. Toby Moskowitz, the Yale finance professor, is joining us here on Dirt and Sprague. We're talking about the economy, and we'll dive into some analytics sports stuff with him. We'll do it next on The Fan. We're going to continue on with Toby Moskowitz, Yale finance professor, also teaches sports analytics as well. As he mentions, that's what happens when you get tenure. You kind of dictate the terms and what you want to teach. He wrote a book on sports analytics, and he's agreed to hang on for another segment. So thank you, Toby, so much for hanging on for about a minute and a half. I kind of want to I want to get your thoughts. What would you tell like the middle class average American out there listening right now? What would your advice be to them as best as you could do? What would you say to that person?
I mean, that's, you know, it's the same thing I've been saying to a lot of my friends who are in that spot that you mentioned. You know, It's you know, hang on as long as you can, do what you can at work. And, you know, this is, I guess the best way to say it is, and I think the best advice I was given by some of the doctors is, if we all act as if we have the disease already and don't want to spread it to others, that social, whether you call it social distancing or whether we end up going quarantining, that's really the only way to get ahead of this thing while medical research catches up. And then we will come out ahead on this thing eventually. But to minimize the disruption, it's kind of like, I guess the way I would put it is, we're all going to have to take some major pain for the next couple of months. The more pain we take right now, the less we're, the you know, the it's lower the duration of that pain. In other words, you know, I'd rather have it be very painful for a month or two and then things start getting back to normal rather than somewhat painful for 6 months to a year. I think unfortunately, these are bad trade-offs, but I think those are the choices that we're facing.
Yeah, we got an interesting question from a listener. I thought the one angle that I haven't really thought of this in the economy impact about just the mortgage industry and the small banks and mortgage lenders here in the short term and just how you see this playing out with people being able to buy houses over the next, who knows how long, you know, year and a half.
Yeah, I mean, that market right now is basically shut down. I have a colleague who was closing on a house, and they said, "Look, we'll have to see you in a couple of months, right? We're done here for now. It's just on hold." That's a great example of an industry where if we drag this out, it's going to be a while before that gets back up. Whereas, you know, if we shut it down completely for a couple of months, it's not pretty, but you know, we may slowly get back there. And that's a good example of an industry where I think targeted government subsidies or fiscal stimulus would be very appropriate, right? Other industries, not so much, but a blanket check to everybody seems a bit, you know, inefficient.
Right. Well, and then even on that note, too, like right now I'm looking at refinancing my house just where interest rates are at. Does that seem like a pretty good way for people to add some money to their pockets every single month? And where do you see interest rates going?
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. Sorry. Now I realize your question was more specific. No, in fact, I told my brother to refinance right after, you know, I refinanced. It's a great time. You know, the only sticking point is you still need to get an appraisal and someone to come out to your property, which he's not too happy about. But it's kind of a necessary condition. I think that's the case. Look, I think it's impossible to predict where interest rates are going to go, but They're zero now, right? Or effectively zero. They can go negative, by the way, but it's unlikely they're going to go much lower. So I think now's a great time to refinance. That doesn't, you know, that helps people out more in the long term than the short term. But absolutely, why not do that? In terms of other types of investments, ways to profit, it's tough right now. I think most people are worried about their jobs and where their income's going to come from. And I think that's the primary concern for most people.
Can I ask you, because we stayed away from it in the last segment, could I ask you the doomsday scenario of, you know, people projected what unemployment could get if this thing is not gone away by a certain amount of time? Have you ran those kind of numbers and what that kind of looks like for us?
Well, I haven't personally, but I know people who have, and I know labor economists are thinking about this. I think the doomsday scenario is one where, you know, it could come from two places. One is it leads to the same place, though, which is, let's suppose that the hospitals get overrun, people get ridiculously sick, and the economy shuts down from that perspective, or we do these kind of very painful social distancing measures, but we do them for way too long and the disease keeps coming back and we don't get ahead of this. That could also be painful, but you end up in a place where we could be in a depression, much like this is a doomsday scenario, but this is, you know, right after the 1929 stock market crash, where you have this massive unemployment rate and it's hard for small businesses, can't start up. No one knows where to work. There aren't any jobs. It becomes a total mess. I'm hoping we don't get to that point. We've learned a lot over the last century that I hope we can at least curb that and not end up in that place. But I think if we don't do some smart things, that is a possibility, and that would be a disaster.
Is there a timeline that you've heard about that? Like if we were to do the social distancing for X, it would get to, let's say, 3-4 months. Like how far in do you think before we get to that point?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, again, these are all models. There are differences of opinion. They're all based on assumptions. The stuff that I have found compelling has been what people call sort of the hammer and dance method, which is one of these where you do, you know, it involves, you know, putting on very strong restrictions in certain places, doing a ton of testing, and moving those restrictions around to where they're most needed. So it's a combination, it's very much what South Korea has done. It's very much a combination of shutting things down for short periods of time, let's say 3 weeks, 2 to 3 weeks, doing a ton of testing, figuring out where the virus is, where it's likely to go next, and imposing those restrictions there, and then slowly lifting them in some places or some sectors where you can do it safely without spreading the epidemic. But this involves a great deal of data and attention. And this is something that's frustrated me as a data scientist, which is the United States, with all of our resources and all of our talent here, we are so far behind on the data front, and there's no excuse for it.
Right.
And that would have saved us, I think it could have saved us months of pain.
Well, it's interesting, too, to look at this from the sports angle as a sports radio show, and just uncharted waters for a lot of leagues financially. We've already seen some owners. I know the 76ers owner came out and was trying to cut wages to his employees, and then there's a lot of social media backlash, and he said, oh, I'm just kidding. We're not going to actually do that. But the NBA's had a real tough fiscal year considering what happened in China to start the season and now going through all of this. Just financially, how do you see this playing out for sports leagues that don't know how long they're going to pay their players? How do you pay your employees? Like, it's just a weird environment from them as well.
It really is. You know, thankfully, I you know, certainly the NBA is in reasonable financial health. I think that they'll be fine. Same with NFL, baseball, even hockey. My guess is that that will be the case. But yeah, they're taking a huge hit. They are completely shut down. And again, I think if you ask them, at least if I was working at the NBA office, my perspective would be, let's get through this virus as quickly as possible, because, you know, a fiscal stimulus to our discussion earlier isn't going to affect the NBA. Even if the NBA started opening up games next week, would you go? Most of us wouldn't go,
right?
I mean, that's just the reality of it. We'd be happy to watch it on TV, but most of us wouldn't go to the game. So that's not going to happen until we get through this. My guess is they would all be for, you know, a short-term pain and get back playing soon. But yeah, it's a huge hit on those. And look, don't forget, it's not just the leagues. The people I worry about more are all the side vendors that whose livelihood depends on those NBA games. You're talking about parking attendants, hot dog and beer sales people. They're, you know, a lot of them working not on salary. And, you know, I love what like Mark Cuban and some have done, which is donated money to and paying those vendors that aren't even a part of the franchise, but certainly support the franchise. That's where the big unemployment will come from.
Yeah. Toby Moskowitz is our guest, professor of finance at Yale University, also does analytics in sports, and he wrote a book on it as well. I do want to ask, because, you know, there's those the people put out those timelines where it's like I've always heard like every 8 to 10 years, the market, you go into recession. That's just kind of been the norm with the two crashes that we've had. I'm curious, does something like this that's different, right, where it's a health-related issue that kind of changes the way everything is, and now these big companies want bailouts because they didn't see this coming, they didn't do anything wrong. Does something like this, in your opinion, change the trajectory of every blank amount of years expected, or do you think this just, once we get out of it, it goes right back to what it was?
That's a great question, and I don't know that I know the answer. I certainly don't know the answer, but I think what's always true about markets is there, you know, it is true that we always expect to see crises or crashes. We just never know when they're going to occur, and it's always going to be something different, right? So it's a banking crisis versus, you know, a decade earlier it was the tech bubble versus, you know, all kinds of other things. Now it's a health crisis. It's always going to be something different. The key thing, I think, is not that it's always the same remedy, but I think over time there has been some learning about what financial and economic tools can be useful. And this is the one thing that I think, you know, governments ought to be willing to do. This is why I love the Denmark experiment, is governments are in a unique position to try stuff. And yeah, it's scary to try stuff because it may not work out. But I think if you try stuff, collect data and learn from it, it's the only way to get better. So I would hope that we're getting better and better at dealing with these crises, but they're not going to go away. I don't know when the next one will be, whether it's going to be 5 years from now, 10, 20, but there will surely be one of some sort. It will be from something totally different, most likely. But hopefully we're a little bit better at dealing with it. This one's pretty unique. Let's be honest. I mean, you know, it's been a century.
Yeah, it's very unique. What's your favorite sport to break down analytically?
Well, the easiest one, of course, is baseball, because it's the easiest one to analyze. But at the same time, I love dissecting football, because it's just so difficult to do. Yeah, there's 22 moving parts on every play. Baseball's easy because it's usually one, maybe two players involved. The rest are kind of irrelevant. It's a very easy sport to analyze, which is why they're so far ahead. But that's good, because you get great answers. Football is just, you know, it's a mess. 22 moving parts, all kinds of stuff going on, but that's also what makes it challenging. But, you know, I like it all. Even analyzing tennis, even sports I don't even know that well, like cricket. It's all cool if you get the right data and have the right questions.
How old were you when you realized being along idiots like myself in school where you were like, yeah, I am substantially smarter than everybody in this room?
First of all, you guys keep saying this, but you're asking very good questions. So I feel like I'm being sandbagged here.
It's the best thing we can do is dumb people, Toby, is ask a good question.
I've always looked at it differently, which is I was always just curious and like to ask questions. Sometimes, by the way, sometimes they're dumb questions. I think those are good. I never like that my students always say to me, I don't want to ask any dumb questions. I'm like, look, this is good to ask dumb questions. That's how you learn. I mean, how do you think I learned? So I don't think I ever sat there and thought I know more than anybody sitting around here. I was just willing to ask questions that maybe others weren't willing to ask. And then I think the key thing is then listening to the answer. If you don't listen to the answer, even when that's not so helpful. And I try to learn from that. I tell my students that as well, especially my doctoral students who are trying to become professors themselves, which is, look, you're always going to learn. Even some of the brightest guys I've met in my field who have Nobel Prizes, they constantly present their work and want feedback from it because they know they don't know everything. And as soon as you recognize that, you can learn an awful lot.
I'll get you out of here on this one. I could talk to you all day. I love hearing the insight on some of this stuff. What is your gut or what does your instinct say how we get out of this? Ultimately, we get to a point, the vaccines are out there, we can start living life normally. Hopefully it doesn't get too bad economically, but let's say it doesn't go very well. What does your gut say that how we rebound from this?
Yeah, I mean, you know my wish list, which would be I would love to see us test like crazy and send resources towards the medical profession with more equipment, more masks, more respiratory. You know, just get through this for the next couple of months and just hit it really hard, right? Hard in terms of restrictions, hard in terms of resources being invested at saving people's lives. I think if we do that, we give ourselves time, and I think we will come up with a vaccine. You know, best estimates are it's probably a year away, maybe a little less than that, but maybe we end up with some treatments even sooner than that. And then once we're through this, what I would love to see long term is put some policies in place that when the next pandemic happens, which it will happen at some point, right? There'll be some new disease. We're just better prepared, better ready. We know how to deal with this stuff. And once those things are in place, you're going to see markets just respond, right? What markets want to know is, do we have a handle on this? Do we know if there's going to be thousands of people afflicted or millions, right? There's those two big differences. Do we know what the disruption will be? Will it be months or will it be years? Those are the things that are plaguing markets right now, and that's why they're going so crazy. The more we get a handle on that and the sooner, the more we're going to see much better outcomes and get back to business.
Yeah.
And it's one thing we're good at in America, right? Yeah. I mean, when we get behind something, we're really good at getting that done. We just need to get behind what's the right approach here.
Sorry to do this. I got one more. How much does the media, this could be a stupid question, how much does the media play a factor in the market, the way the economy goes, like driving up, hey, fear-based driven media of, hey, people are dying, this is serious. Does that play a factor?
Yeah, there's debate on this. I mean, my famous colleague Bob Shiller at Yale, who won the Nobel Prize in 2013, he certainly believes that that's the case, and I think there's some truth to this, which is he described that narratives can drive a lot of the stock market, at least in the short term, and I think the media plays a huge role in that. Now, is that going to affect things long term? I would argue no, but I think in the short term, you might say that markets may have been swinging much more wildly than they should have been if you actually looked at the information that's out there. But, what do you do about it? I guess if you really believe that that's the case, then you think it's maybe a good time to buy in the stock market. But things are so volatile. I'm always skeptical of that.
Right. Yeah. Toby Moskowitz, finance professor at Yale University, also teaches sports analytics as well. Toby, thank you so much for agreeing to come on. I know you're super busy right now. You probably get hit up for a lot of these interviews. So we are very gracious for your time. Thank you for calling us from home. And I'm sure we'd love to get you on at some point, and we'll maybe talk about football analytics next time and not the economy potentially crashing.
That would be great.
All right. Thank you, Toby.
All right, thanks, guys. Thanks for having me on.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.